So, welcome everyone. Welcome to Journey of the Soul, a brand new and exciting JLI course starting tonight and will continue for 5 additional Monday evenings at 7:30. Of course, including tonight, that will be 6 classes in total. And I want to give us a special welcome. In addition to the welcome to existing and returning JLI students, I want to give a special welcome to first-time JLI students. So if you are a first-time JLI student, would you please give us a wave so we can see who you are? Okay, a nice bunch of waves there, a bunch of hands. So thank you for joining, a warm welcome. This is an awesome community of learners. And I'm sure you will enjoy this course, and who knows, God willing, additional courses afterwards. Mm-hmm. Special thank you to a couple of our course sponsors. I want to thank Sid Waldman, who I see, of Waldman Funeral Care. Thank you very much for joining and for your sponsorship. In addition, I also want to thank an additional sponsor, who I believe is just joining us, Jim Adler. Thank you very much for your sponsorship as well. There you are, Jim, just in time. Thank you for your sponsorship and thank you for joining. So they tell a story about this guy, Abe, who was out on a date, and he told a friend in advance that he should call him at exactly 9 o'clock. Because you never know how the evening is going to unfold. And just to be safe, he wanted a way out. So his loyal friend did as he asked. He got the phone call. And after half a minute, he hung up the phone and he lowered his eyes. He put on this grim expression. And he said, "I have some bad news. My grandfather just passed away." And the girl sitting across him said, "Thank God." So he said, "Like, what? What does that mean?" So she said, "Well, if your grandfather didn't die, then mine would have had to. It's just a joke." So once again, welcome and thank you for joining. Before we begin, we want to try to figure out why we are here today. Why are we even studying about end of life? Why is it relevant? You would think that there are some more greater priorities of what we should be learning about, spending our time studying, perhaps how to navigate challenges that are before us, how to get through this dark and confusing world, how to enhance our relationships. Why are we gathering to spend 6 evenings together discussing what seems to be a conversation about death? So we want to know, first of all, what's interesting about this topic, what's interesting to you, and why. And I'm just going to ask a few of you to share within, if you can, 10 to 15 seconds. If you can just unmute and tell us what brought you to this class tonight and why you find this topic interesting. Just go ahead and unmute and share something brief.
I find it interesting because everyone has different opinions about it.
Okay. Sounds like a Jewish group here. Go ahead.
Well, this I'm is interested. Go ahead.
I'm interested in thanatology, the science of death. As a funeral director, it interests me a great deal. But Jewishly, it interests me spiritually.
Okay, thank you for sharing, Sid. It makes sense. Anne?
It interests me because I think that as we grow old, that we become more friendly with death, but that in our youth, whatever we consider that to be, that there's an underlying fear of death, and that that fear of death can be mild, moderate, severe, whatever.
Okay, thank you, Joanne. Now, Anne.
It's interesting. When I first saw this class, I had a little bit of fear of signing up because I didn't want to really know about it or address it, because the people close to me, I don't want to think about the possibility of death. But then when I read more about it, what I think is that I want to know more about it and how to deal with it and how it is a part, and really it's woven into our everyday life, especially the last year. It's really pertinent to our lives now. So as I thought more about it, I wanted to know more about how to deal with it and make it a reality, and it's part of life.
Thank you, Ann. One more?
I'm interested in this class because as a young person, I spent a lot of years in the military during our wars on terror. So I've been surrounded by death at all angles, including...
Lost you there. James, we don't hear you. You froze up there. Maybe Lou, go ahead. We'll come back to James.
I lost my father 25 years ago. And at that time, I started studying Jewish death, mourning, rituals, and practices. I've read probably close to a dozen books on it over that 25 years, including books on the soul. Is there a soul? What is a soul? How does the soul relate to us? I just find it a very fascinating topic, and this fits into the genre of my study.
Thank you. Thank you, Lou. Sean, please.
Well, sort of to build on that, actually, I'm not that interested in a course about death, but I do find the discussion of the soul to be fascinating. And okay. So that's what pulled me in.
Okay, excellent. Okay, one more. Donna, please.
I have always wondered about the Jewish view on death and whether there's an afterlife and what it might be. And I'm in a family where we've had a number of deaths. In fact, it's appropriate I'm starting tonight because today was my little sister's yahrzeit. So I just finished service. But my parents, my dad, was convinced that there was nothing after death. It just stopped. My mother feels the same way. My sister and I believe that somehow my little sister and my baby brother and my father are all up there somewhere together. And I've never been able to figure out what the Jewish view is. And I know when you say that, you have to say what the 1,000 different Jewish views are on that.
Okay, thank you, Donna. So I appreciate all the sentiments and the feelings that were shared. I just want to add before we continue that on a personal note, I was and am looking forward to this course, of course, teaching it and sharing it with you. Those that know myself and my family know that this year was one with unfortunately several losses. First of all, I lost my father about 10 months ago. I'm still reciting Kaddish for him twice a day. I was at services about an hour ago for this evening, and I'll continue doing so for another 4 weeks till 11 months conclude, and we'll discuss that actually later on in the course. I also lost a younger brother who suffered from Down syndrome. That was about 4 months ago. And if that wasn't enough, my mother-in-law, Esty's mother, lost both of her parents. So Esty's grandparents within 3 months of each other, just 3 and 6 months ago. So it's been a very loaded year in that sense. So I'm certainly looking forward to what this course has to teach me. And not just preaching, God forbid, but sharing these insights and actually incorporating them and hopefully finding inspiration myself as well. So it's super timely for me. So let's just talk about the primary objectives of this course. And it was very interesting to hear the various different perspectives, and let's see how they'll fit into what the course objective is. Just a reminder to try to remain muted, except for when we'll open it up to Q&A and a couple of opportunities, of course, for the successful flow of the class. Okay, so number one, when it comes to death, we have some theological and philosophical issues. We have a hard time wrapping our mind around these ideas. What happens to the soul? What is a soul? What happens to the soul? What's the purpose of death? Is there heaven and hell? Does Judaism believe in reincarnation? A lot of philosophical questions that emerge. We also have emotional issues. If somebody, God forbid, suffered a loss of a loved one, leaving a gaping hole, leaving a void behind, how do we deal with that emotionally? How are we able to move on from that? How do we find comfort and consolation? How do we find perspective? How do we recover from that? And lastly, there are practical issues. Of course, whether it's for ourselves or for a loved one, what do we do? What does Judaism say as far as how to prepare for end of life, for a grandparent, for a parent? Who knows? So we'll be addressing and dealing with all these themes tonight and in the following six classes. I'm certain that everyone that spoke up before and those that didn't will find a lot of life-enriching insight, information, insight, and hopefully inspiration. So what we're going to do now, again, before we actually jump in, not everyone reacts the same way when we discuss death and mortality. And I want to ask as many of you as possible to unmute yourself and tell me in one word answers only, which one word comes to mind when you hear about death, which one reaction, what does it evoke in you in one word? You can unmute and go.
Reincarnation.
Sadness.
Sad.
Sadness, sad, reincarnation.
Relief.
What was that?
Loss.
Relief.
Relief.
Change.
Say that again.
Change.
Change. Okay. Anything else?
Fear.
Elena?
Fear.
Fear. Okay.
Disappointment.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah.
Anyone else?
Emptiness.
Emptiness.
Goodbye.
Goodbye. Yeah. Anything else? One word. What?
Two words.
Sad.
Sad. Yeah. Okay. Thank you all. Just a reminder to mute once again. Thank you for sharing. All great responses. Thank you for that. So the essential questions that we're going to be discussing in today's lesson revolve around feelings of our own mortality. What is the Jewish perspective on death? Is death to be feared? Should it be embraced? Should it be ignored? Because all of us experience, it's inevitable that we experience ups and downs in our life and disappointments and sometimes tragedy. However, nothing compares, as bad as any of the above are, nothing compares to the experience of a loss. And that's because everything else, even if someone is, God forbid, very ill, even terminally ill, there's still somewhere inside of us where we're praying for a miracle. There's a measure of hope that something can still turn around with God's help. However, when it comes to death, there is a sense of finality that nothing else compares to. And there, because it's so final, unlike anything else, and so irrevocable, that there it instills or creates a very strong sense of fear. It's very scary. Talking about it is uncomfortable. And that's because it is forever. Now, how do we address this anxiety that's produced by these thoughts? And there's actually a word for it. Someone alluded to this word before. This word is called thanatophobia. Thanatophobia is called fear of death. And we're going to take a look at what psychologists have to say about this idea and how universal this fear actually is. So if you could open to page 3 in your student books, that would be incredible. And I'm going to call upon some of you to read some of the texts as in the course of the evening. If you're okay with it, if you prefer not to read, then we can very easily pass it to the next person. I'm going to start with Lou. If you can please read text number 1 for us, please.
Thanatophobia. Welcome to an exploration of and journey into the Jewish traditions and insights surrounding the topics of death and the afterlife.
1 second, Lou. Is that text number 1?
I'm sorry.
On page 3?
I'm sorry, I'm looking at page 2.
No problem. Page 3, text okay. Number 1.
All right. Mortality has haunted us from the beginning of history. 4,000 years ago, the Babylonian hero Gilgamesh reflected on the death of his friend Enkidu with the words, "Thou hast become dark and cannot hear me. When I die, shall I not be like Enkidu? Sorrow enters my heart. I am afraid of death." Gilgamesh speaks for all of us. As he feared death, so do we all, each and every man, woman, and child. For some of us, the fear of death manifests only indirectly, either as generalized unrest or masqueraded as another psychological symptom. Other individuals experience an explicit and conscious stream of anxiety about death. And for some of us, the fear of death erupts into terror that negates all happiness and fulfillment.
Thank you very much, Lou. So the reality is that psychologists argue that for many people, whether it's conscious or subconscious, the fear of death actually dictates a lot of our behavior. A lot of the decisions that we make are inspired by that deep-seated fear, again, whether we realize it or if we don't. So it's a real thing. It's there, and it doesn't mean we all feel it. It certainly doesn't mean that we should be fearful. Certainly not, as we'll discuss this evening, from the Jewish perspective. But they just argue that that is just how it is. So in reality, and as someone noted before, that what attracted them to this course isn't a conversation about death per se. The truth is, what we're going to find unique about this course is that, of course, we'll learn about end of life. But more than that, we're going to learn how death actually, what it teaches us about life, and it's going to inspire us a lot about life. So with that, and with this introduction, we're going to jump in. And the first thing that we're going to do is discuss the fact that in Jewish thought, from the Jewish perspective, death is not considered the end of life. The Jewish perspective on death is not the end of life, but rather the beginning of another phase of life. So if we're saying that death is not really the end of life, it's just a new phase of life, then we have to discuss what life is all about. We have to first discuss life to appreciate and understand what it means that death is another new phase of life. So what is life, for that matter? What is life? And in fact, we're going to ask the question of who are we really? Who am I? When I say I, what am I referring to? Who is the I? When any of us say I, who is the real I when we think about the very core of our being? Who are we at the core? And this is a very important question, and very important to our conversation, because you know there's a lot of things. Unless someone is more the philosophical type, you know, as a rabbi, I meet a lot of people, and I find very often that for the first several decades of life, and I don't mean from birth, but even from age 20, or 25, 30, when people start their lives, they start a family, they're focused on raising their children, they're focused on building up their business and their careers. And most people, and I'm not generalizing, it's not black and white, but largely people don't spend a whole lot of time thinking about who they are, what the soul is, who is the real me, unless someone is the philosophical type. But for the most part, people don't think about it. Unless, number one, sometimes they reach a certain age and they start asking themselves the bigger questions in life. Or something is thrown their direction in life. They experience something that makes them think. Perhaps a loss in the family, and they start thinking about what it means, what's the purpose in it, where is my loved one, et cetera, et cetera. So we start thinking about what is a soul, and what is our life all about. So just a general thing here for the entire course, I just want to share with you that the sources that we're going to be drawing upon, yes, a little bit of psychology, as we just did in text number one, but as far as Judaism is concerned, we're going to be drawing on classical Jewish texts, the Talmud, the Midrash, and Jewish mystical sources as well, drawing on the Kabbalists. And that's where we're going to be getting the vast majority of our insight that's going to be informing all the perspectives, Jewish perspectives, that we are going to be discussing throughout this course. So let's take a look at text number two. Rabbi Chaim Vital, as you can see. He was a student of one of the greatest Kabbalists of all time, known as the Arizal. And he tells us very succinctly, in just a few lines, he tells us who we really are. When I say I, who is that I? Can I ask Ann Miller to please read text number two? Just unmute yourself and please read it on page five.
See, is death the end of who we are?
Number two, you see that
on page five?
Yeah,
The wise are aware that the human body is not the human being. When we speak of the human being, we are referring to the human's inner dimension. The body is merely a garment in which the soul is attired during its sojourn in this world.
Thank you. So when I say I'm not referring to a particular body part. I'm not talking about my head. I'm not talking about my heart. I'm not even talking about my body as a whole. I am referring to my soul because the body is just a garment to my soul. And I'm not even referring to my knowledge or intellect, emotions, feelings, fears. All of that is not the real I. The real I is the soul, known in Hebrew as the neshama. Neshama or nefesh. So big idea number one on page six, figure 1.2, who am I? The real me is my soul. That's what the Jewish mystics teach us. The real me is my soul, not my body. Just think about, I know where I come from, everybody had gloves. I don't know how many people have gloves in Houston. Well, maybe nowadays people have gloves. But think of a glove, not a mitten. If you put your hand in a glove, then suddenly the glove looks like it's alive, right? We're going to use this simple analogy because the simpler we go, the clearer it will be. Now, as long as you're wearing the glove is able to move and it looks like it's alive. When you take the glove off and put it on the table, there's no life left to the glove at all. The analog is obvious. The glove is our body and our hand is like the soul. The body isn't the real me. The body is just a garment. It's a garment to my soul, which is the real me. So as long as my soul is within the body is alive. The body is able to move and able to function and do everything that a body that's alive can do. But the moment that the soul departs from the body, just like the hand leaving the glove, the body is left lifeless. In other words, I am the soul, and the soul gives life to the body. If I ask you, which one needs which? Does the soul need the body or the body need the soul? Obviously, the body is what needs the soul, certainly at this stage of our discussion. The body needs the soul to give it life. The soul does not need the body. Now, try to think of some analogy in your own mind of what the body and soul are like. You could think of a car. The car is like the body. The engine is the soul. And there's many other, anything else that you could think of. Think of two entities where one is compared to the body, the other to the soul. Now, we can't really understand the soul, but we can try to learn about the soul. We're never going to know what it really is because we can't see it. We just know that it's there because when you look at a person and they're alive, you know that there's a soul there. If I'm talking to you, you know that there's a soul in me that is giving me life, that is vivifying my body, and that's why I'm able to function. So we're going to try to understand the soul from learning about it. Let us turn to two texts, which are the Torah, the Bible's description. Of course, it comes from Genesis, the very beginning of creation. How does the Bible describe the creation of the first human being versus the creation of animals? So I'm going to ask someone to read 3a and 3b, but I want everyone else to please follow along. And if you can share with me afterwards, maybe in the chat box, share with me what difference do you pick up in between the way humans were created versus how animals were created. Can I ask Ralph, please, to if you can unmute and please read text 3a and 3b.
God formed the human of soul from the earth and breathed into his nostrils the neshama of life, and the human being became a living being.
Okay, so that's how the first human was created. Go ahead with B.
God said, let the earth bring forth living beings of different species, cattle, creeping things, and beasts of the earth according to their species, and it was so.
Thank you. By raise of hand, do you detect a difference from how animals were created versus how the first human being was created? Eloise?
Yes. God formed the human, and he let the earth bring forth the animals.
Okay, thank you. Anyone else? Sean?
Yes, he mentions a soul with humans, but doesn't with the animals.
Okay. I'm not going to dwell on it now, but it doesn't mean that animals don't have souls, but we'll save that. Anyone else?
God specifically and particularly had a hand in forming the human and giving it life.
Okay, one more. Okay, I'll go. Nick, sorry, there you go.
In the case of the human being, God actually put part of himself into the human being, in a sense, by blowing his spirit into the human being.
Okay, thank you, Nick, and thank you all for sharing. Some of you are super close, and this is what we're picking up here. When it comes to the human being, the creation of the first human was in two phases versus the animal, which was in one phase, one act of creation. What are the two phases of the creation of the human being? First, God creates the body, and the body was an entity of its own. It was a lump of clay. It was a thing for itself. And then, whether it was 5 seconds later or 5 minutes later, but it was stage number two. The second act was God breathing the breath of life into the body of the first human being, as opposed to the animal, where God created it from the first second, it was already alive. Soul and body were already together by animals. By the first human, it was the body first, and then came the soul and gave life to the body. So, but again, by the animal, the hardware and the software came together. By man, it was the hardware first, and then came the software, then came the soul. So what does that tell us? What insight are we able to draw from this difference? So for that, we go to text 3C, continuing where we were on page number 7. Nadine, would you like to read 3C for us? Just unmute if you would like to, please.
God did what he had not done with any other creature. He blew into Adam with his Holy Spirit a neshama that is immortal and does not perish when the body does.
Thank you. What this tells us is the difference in between the way man versus the first human versus animal and their method of creation. It tells us that the soul and the body of a human being are two different entities. The body was created first, then the soul came in. In other words, they have different origins. The soul existed before it was put into the body, and even after the soul ceases to exist, even after the body ceases to exist, the soul lives on afterwards. Just like its origin is different, it also continues on beyond the body and independent of the body. Am I making sense? So far, so good? Okay. So if you can join me on page number 8 in figure 1.3. So far, our two big ideas, just to sum up. Number one, the real me is my soul, not my body, that we established before. The real me is my soul, not my body. Now we just added another dimension to that. Number two, the real me, the soul, is eternal. So I am eternal, if the real me is my soul. And the soul existed, as we quoted from scripture. The soul existed before it came into the body. And therefore it exists beyond the body. The body has a shelf life. The body has an expiration date. The soul doesn't. The soul continues to live on afterwards. So what we're concluding here is that if I am my soul and my soul is eternal, then I am eternal. So far, so good?
Yeah.
Okay. So number one, we established that the Jewish perspective on death is that death doesn't end life. The body ends, but life is the soul, and the soul doesn't end. The soul continues. Okay. So let's, you know what, I'm going to show the first lesson video, a short video. I'm going to share my screen, and we're going to hear a great scholar who we actually hosted twice for a Shabbaton right here in Bel Air, and he's going to expound on this idea and illustrate this idea of the body and soul a little bit more. So pay attention to the screen.
Hi, this is Rabbi Shaystab. Welcome to a series of meditations for the course Journey of the Soul. The purpose of these meditations is going to be internalizing some of the deeper ideas that are a little bit difficult to grasp. And generally, we will try to do so by way of visualization, trying to picture symbols that represent some of the ideas and that we can focus on briefly so that we can begin to connect on a deeper level to these ideas. To begin with, the entire notion of life is a challenging concept because it is so intangible. We're used to relating to things, to that which we can see, to that which we can touch. And life,
whoops. Let me try that one more time. Can't go without some technological difficulties. I don't know why it's not playing. Maybe I'll give it one quick try.
is a challenging concept because it is so intangible. We're used to relating to things, to that which we can see, to that which we can touch. And life is completely intangible. How do we begin to relate to that which is unseeable, untouchable? How do we envision, how do we see the unseeable? So if you will, I'll ask you to begin right now, however you're most comfortable doing so. Close your eyes, keep your eyes open. Envision a musical instrument, a physical object, let's say a piano made of wood and wires, something you can look at with your physical eyes, you can touch it with your physical hands. It's a physical object. Now, the piano is merely a thing. A person comes over to the piano, the pianist sits down and begins playing a beautiful song. Now this song stirs your soul. Try to hear it. Hear the music. Where is the song? Can you see it? Can you touch it? You can see and touch the piano. You can't see or touch the song. And now the song is over. And the piano is standing there. If you'll open up the piano, will you find the song?
Yeah.
Think now how everything in the world is matter and energy. The matter is the physical object that we see, the piano. Energy is the intangible, the song. Take a half a minute now to try to think of ourselves in these terms. Think of your body as the instrument, the physical object that can be seen, that can be touched. And think of the life you live as the song that is being played through the instrument. Take half a minute right now to
Okay. So, hope that added some clarity in explaining the ideas we discussed so far. Okay, I'm going to add one more big idea, and then we'll take a couple questions. So, for the next big idea, just building on the previous two, we're going to turn to texts number 4 and 5. And I'm going to Deborah, would you like to read for us? If you'd like to, if you can open to page number 8 and read text number 4 and 5, which come from the Midrash and the Mishnah.
Please. Okay. 40 days before the conception of a child, God summons the angel in charge of souls and tells him, "Bring before me a certain soul that is now in paradise. Its name is such and such, and its appearance is such and such. This is possible because all the souls that are born in this world were created on the day the world was created and exist until the end of time." The angel goes and brings the soul before God. The soul bows and prostrates itself before the Supreme King of Kings. God instructs the soul, "Please enter the seminal drop that is currently in the hands of the angel in charge of pregnancy." The soul protests, "Master of the universe, I am quite satisfied with the world I inhabited since the day you created me. I am holy and pure, hewn from your throne of glory. Why do you wish to cause me to enter this putrid drop?"
Thank you. Number 5.
Okay, next page, right? Okay. "This world is like a corridor before the world to come. Prepare yourself in this corridor so that you may enter the palace. A single moment of bliss in the world to come is greater than all of this world."
Thank you. What you may have picked up from these two texts we are seeing here that not only is the soul not a physical being, as we established before, but the soul is not even interested in this physical world. When the angel turns to this soul and says, your number has been called, and now it's your turn to descend into a body and into the earthly, lowly world, it actually resists, and it's a struggle, and it doesn't want to go. There's actually a beautiful song written about this, and it wants to stay in heaven. Heaven's its comfort zone. When it's going to go down into a body and into the world, that's like it's going to be on a foreigner, on strange soil. It wants to stay in heaven. And after it's the allotted time of that soul in the body here in this world, when its allotted time comes to an end and the soul returns to heaven, it's actually returning to a very pleasurable place, exactly where it came from. So what these tell us is this. Let's take a look at figure 1.4 on page 10. And again, just reviewing and summarizing what we learned so far. Number one, who am I? Number one, the real me is my soul, not my body. Number two, the real me, the soul, is eternal. So I am eternal. Number three, the real eternal me is relatively unaffected by birth or death. It never really wanted, the soul never wanted to come into this world. And when it gets to return to heaven, it actually is returning to its home, where it came from. So the time that it spends here on earth in a body is quite insignificant or incidental to the soul from this perspective at this point. So now I'll take a quick question or two if somebody has one. I'm going to take them, but I'm letting you know in advance that we have to be brief because I want to cover all the material within our allotted time. Lou, go ahead.
I don't know that I can agree with the fact that you presented that the soul was incidental to life on Earth in this world.
Excellent, Lou. And in 15 minutes from now, you're going to agree with me. That's the next section. So it's a healthy reaction you just had. Anyone else? Deborah? Anyone else?
I'm still waiting for you to make your case.
Okay. So we're going to advance. So I just said what Lou disagreed with because that's not the full picture. That's only half the picture. What I said so far, that the soul comes from heaven, never really wanted to come to earth, and then when it returns to heaven, it's returning to its comfort zone. That is true, but that's only half the story. Because there's a very big on the other hand. When you hear something from a rabbi, you know it's going to be followed by on the other hand. So on the other hand, we may come to the conclusion, based on what I said, that life on earth is, you know, nonchalant to the soul, or that Judaism views life on earth as something flippant, which is categorically not true. So the truth is that there are certain sages that testify that when they lived among other religions, for example, there's a great sage known as the Radvaz, and he's a 16th century sage, and he wrote that he lived among Muslims. And he said that they did not let people tear their garments when experiencing a death, because that would be overdoing their grief, when in truth the soul is returning to heaven, and that's not something to grieve over. And he wrote this about other religions. Judaism totally disagrees with this. And Judaism sees a life lost from this earth as a tragedy. And that's why we mourn, and that's why we grieve, and we'll be discussing more of this in the later classes. So that's certainly not the case. So we definitely should not conclude that Judaism looks at life on earth as something nonchalant. In fact, from the perspective of Judaism, life on earth is paramount. As we all know that Judaism views the sanctity of life as the highest priority, and anything, any commandment, any mitzvah in the Torah is suspended in order to preserve life. Not only that, you may be surprised to know that even if someone is ill to the extent that that naturally they have no way of healing, and the doctors, let's say, gave them a limited amount of time to live, and you have a question, let's say it's Shabbat, and maybe you're in the hospital with that patient, or it could be at home, and you have a question of if you should violate Shabbat in order to extend this person's life for 1 minute. 1 minute of life for someone who the doctor said will never get better. You actually do desecrate Shabbos to extend the life of someone who's terminally ill, even for a moment. That tells us how valuable Judaism looks at life, any life, even just extending someone's life for a few moments with no chance naturally to heal. So we should never come to the conclusion that Judaism sees it any differently. And saving a life precedes almost everything in Judaism. Now, the question then is, that it's kind of confusing here, because on one hand, we're saying that when the soul is called upon and told that it's going to be descending into a body, and it's going to enter this lowly world, it's going to go from heaven to earth, what does the soul respond? What did we say before? It resists. It doesn't want to go down. It wants to stay in heaven because that's its comfort zone. It doesn't want anything else. So, okay, if that's the case, then life on earth isn't the greatest thing for the soul. It wants to stay in heaven. Now we're saying something else, that extending life on earth from the Jewish perspective, is done at all costs. And that takes the highest priority in Judaism. So just to confuse you a little bit more, we're going to read text 7 and 8, and then we'll reconcile it. Sid, would you like to read for us, please, on page 13, text 7 and 8, also from the Midrash and the Mishnah, and actually part of the previous text. But this is giving us the flip side.
God hurries to reassure the descending soul. The world to which I am bringing you will provide more beneficial, will prove more beneficial than the one you presently inhabit. Indeed, I formed you exclusively for the purpose of creating mortal life from this particular drop of seed, which that God forcibly installs the soul.
Thank you. And number 8?
A single moment of repentance and of good deeds in this world is greater than all of the world to come.
Thank you. So we have here two sides of the coin. On one hand, the soul does not want to come into the world. But on the other hand, what are we saying? That life on this world and performing good deeds in this world is more valuable than every heavenly pleasure that you can only think of. Let me repeat that. Before, we said the soul wants to stay in heaven and doesn't want to come down to earth. Now the sages are telling us that life on earth has the greatest value, and performing a good deed here on earth is greater than the greatest heavenly pleasures that are possibly conceivable. So raise your hand if you're as confused as I am. Okay, so which one is it? So all of this, both sides of this coin help lead us to a more complete perspective that Judaism has when it comes to life and the end of life. And what is it? So it goes like this. Number one, and again, we're going to repeat. Number one, the soul is eternal. Number two, we have to know that the soul, because it is a divine spiritual entity, wears its greatest pleasure as a spiritual entity. It takes greatest pleasure. Remember that word pleasure? The soul's pleasure is in heaven more than anywhere else. Yet at the same time, why did God create heaven? Why did God create humanity? And why did God create this world? Because this is where it's all at. Heaven is only here, so to speak, as a supporting cast to what's going on in this world. The greatest pleasures exist in heaven, but the greatest value exists on earth. Which one's more important, heaven and earth? The answer is earth. Which one's more pleasurable to the soul? The answer is heaven. So if you want to talk to the soul about pleasure, heaven is going to take precedence. But as soon as you start talking to the soul about its purpose and about its mission, the soul's mission is only on earth. The soul was created so that it should descend into a body, come into this lowly world, and live its allotted time in a body, performing good deeds and making a difference in the world. That's why it was created. As far as pleasure is concerned, heaven is unmatched. But as far as purpose, mission, and value, that the soul gets on earth. And that's why we have two sides to the coin. On one hand, the pleasures of heaven are incomparable. On the other hand, doing a good deed here below in this world one time has greater value than the greatest pleasures of the next world. Am I making sense? Mm. Yeah, thumbs up. Someone has a quick question, I'll take it. I guess everything's good. By the way, if you can also punch your type your question into the chat box if you're more comfortable with that, and I'll do my best to address those as well.
So if I understand, as I try to wrap my head around this, the soul may find more pleasure, more comfort in heaven, but this is then saying that the soul has a mission. The soul has a purpose beyond just finding pleasure in heaven. The soul has a...
Exactly. Howard, I think you're hitting it. If the soul wants to go to where it's comfortable, it's going to go to heaven. But when the soul thinks about what its purpose and mission for which it was created is, that's only on earth. It was created to have its allotted time in a body on earth, and that is how it achieves satisfaction. That's how the soul fulfills its purpose of why it was created. That only happens on earth. But pleasure, that's in heaven. So we're left with two things. Let's take a look at text number 10. And if you could, I'm going to read it and just follow along here. This is how we sum up the reality of the soul and its attitude to life. The Mishnah, the sages write in the Mishnah, which dates back close to 2,000 years. This is how it goes on page 15. Against your will you are formed, and against your will you are born. Against your will you live, and against your will you die. And again, we have the same question. On one hand, we're saying the soul comes down into this world against its will. In other words, it wants to stay in heaven. But once the soul does come into this world and its allotted time is nearing its end, then the soul doesn't want to leave this world, because once it's here, it develops an appreciation for its mission and purpose, and it realizes what value there is in this world that it can't find in heaven. You can't do a mitzvah in heaven. You can't do a good deed. You can't help someone in heaven, only here on earth. So the soul develops an appreciation for life on earth to the extent that when its time comes, it actually doesn't want to leave. It doesn't want to return to heaven. Once the soul spent time on earth, it actually wants to stay here. So when it's created and formed, it's against its will that it's descending into earth. But then when it's time for the soul to depart back to heaven, against its will, does it leave this world? Against your will, do you die? Because once you're here, the soul gains a tremendous amount of appreciation and satisfaction from the things that it can only do in this world. Once it returns to heaven, it can't do a mitzvah anymore. It can't do something. It can't make a difference in the world. It can't do a favor for another person. You can't deliver a meal to a homebound person. You can't do anything good in heaven. Everything's done. The mission is done when the soul returns to heaven. So once it's here, it doesn't want to leave. Just think of someone who is in a job and needs to start a new job. Let's say the new job is a better opportunity. It's more lucrative, but it's also more challenging. So what is a normal person is usually experiencing two things at the same time. On one hand, they know that the right thing for them is to advance to the new job. It's a better opportunity. It's time to move forward. And it's more lucrative, etc. At the same time, it's also very challenging for them to advance to the next step. So they know that there's value waiting for them, but at the same time, it's very difficult. That's like this when the soul is in heaven and is being told of this opportunity to descend into earth, and you'll come into a body. But it's a whole new challenge for the soul. The soul is comfortable in heaven. You put it into a body, it has to deal with an evil inclination. It has to deal with worldly temptations. Which soul wants that? The soul wants to remain in heaven, where it's comfortable, without distractions, enjoying its spiritual delights. It doesn't want to come down to earth. Just like that person who is reluctant and hesitant to take the plunge to the new job, even though they know it's the right thing to do, it's still difficult. And that's the struggle that the soul experiences before coming into this world, and then once again, when it's time to leave this world, after realizing the unique value that can be found only in this world, it doesn't want to leave at that point. It wants to stay. So let's take a look at figure 1.5, please, on page 15. So number one, again, to summarize, we established that death is not the end, because I am the soul and the soul is eternal. But number two, even though death is not the end, it doesn't mean the soul is running back to heaven. Number two is important. Nevertheless, we value life more than anything. So this completes the picture, Lou, and I hope you're appreciating it now. This completes the picture of the Jewish perspective. On one hand, the soul continues to live on, and death is not the end for the soul because it just continues to the next phase. At the same time, as much as it continues on to a new phase, it still values life on earth tremendously and more than anything else, because only here on earth can that soul make an actual difference. Making sense? You can give me a thumbs up if yes. Okay. I see some which are not up, but they're also not down. Okay. I guess we're getting somewhere. Let me just read this question here that came into the chat box. Could it be thought that when we do good deeds on earth, we are as close to heaven as we can get without being dead? So that might be the closest we can get to Hashem on earth. So, okay, thank you, James, for that observation. To clarify, when a soul is here on earth and does a good deed and does a mitzvah, it's not as close to heaven as we can get without being dead. It's actually closer to heaven than the soul can get from being in heaven. When the soul is in heaven, obviously it's experiencing spiritual pleasures. But as far as closeness to God, the soul achieves a closeness to God more than it could in heaven by doing a mitzvah here on earth. And this is why the soul doesn't want to leave earth when its time comes. The soul doesn't want to return to heaven. If being in heaven is closer to God, it's more pleasurable. It's more of a obviously spiritual experience, but it's not deeper. Doing a mitzvah here on earth where we don't experience spiritual delights is closer and develops a deeper relationship to God than any one you can have from being in heaven. And that's why the soul, once it's here, wants to stay here. Because only here could it have that depth in its relationship with God that it cannot achieve by being in heaven. One more question in the chat. Do souls come back to earth since there are only a set number of souls that God created? In other words, you're asking if we believe in reincarnation. The answer is yes. And anyone else that believes in it got it from Judaism, just know that. And we will be discussing it in another one of the classes, so I'm not going to expound on it tonight. But the answer to your question is yes. And I look forward to discussing it in the next opportunity. So I just want to illustrate this point that we've been discussing with a story. And the story really vividly demonstrates this idea. This was in the early 20th century. The sixth Lubavitch Rebbe, he passed away in 1950, actually my namesake. I'm named Yosef Yitzchak after him. And he was, of course, lived in Russia under communism, and he was arrested several times by the Soviet authorities. For what crime? His crime was teaching Judaism under communism, which, of course, they considered counter-revolutionary, and he was actually sentenced to death. Miraculously, he was saved. We're not going to get into his whole story right now. What we're going to do now is read a short entry from his diary. He kept a fascinating diary throughout this whole ordeal. And here's his account of one of his interrogations at the hands of the notorious, what was called then the GPU, eventually became the KGB. So I'm going to ask Donna, would you like to read text number 11 for us, please? Just unmute. And we're on page 16 with text 11.
I arrived for interrogation at the offices of the Soviet GPU. However, in keeping with my principles, I was not very cooperative. One of the interrogators raised a revolver that sat on the desk before him. He looked me in the eye and mockingly said, "This small toy has incredible powers. It causes principles to melt away. It opens mouths. Under its spell, even mutes have become talkative." I responded, "You are quite mistaken. That toy only has an effect on faint-hearted non-believers, those with one world and multiple gods. We, on the other hand, have one God and two worlds. As such, I don't panic at the sight of your toy. It has no effect on me whatsoever."
Thank you, Donna. It's a fascinating entry in his diary here, because he was possibly the only one who stood up to the communists and didn't move an inch throughout his whole arrest. And like I said, it's fascinating, but that's the extent of it for tonight. But we have the insight from his response to this officer. And here is someone who, on one hand, the Rebbe, Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak, absolutely wanted to continue living his life on earth, as he did until 1950. He came to the States in 1940 and brought Judaism to the States, established Chabad in Brooklyn, New York, and then his successor took over in 1950, and the rest is history. So he absolutely wanted to continue his mission. Yet at the same time, he was able to steer death in the face with complete equanimity and serenity of mind. He wasn't overtaken by fear. He wanted to remain here on earth to continue his mission. Yet at the same time, he was able to look at it calm and identify it for what it is. And that's an illustration of everything that we've been discussing so far. Now, on one hand, it's the appreciation of life, and of course, in the other, the lack of fear. And I want to turn to one more Talmudic story, which really drives this point home. I'm going to ask, let's see. Linda, would you like to read for us, please? Text number 12 on page 17. This is out of the Talmud. You need to unmute, please. Word of the year, you're muted.
Yeah. Okay. When Rabbi Judah the prince fell ill and lay on his deathbed, Rabbi Chaya entered and found him weeping. "My master," exclaimed Rabbi Chaya, "why do you weep? Was it not taught if one dies smiling, it is a good sign for him, while weeping, it is a bad sign for him?" Rabbi Judah replied, "I weep because of my inability to study the Torah and observe the commandments after death."
Thank you. What does this story tell us here? And this was about Rabbi Yehuda, who was actually the compiler of the Mishnah, and these were his last moments on earth. So another sage found him on his deathbed and said to him, "Why are you crying?" Because he knew Rabbi Yehuda. He knew that he wouldn't be overtaken by fear of death. So why did he find this great sage in tears before passing away? And his answer gives us a crystal clear perspective of everything that we've been discussing. He wasn't crying because he was afraid of death. He wasn't. He realized that that when God says it's his time, it's his time. Why the tears? The tears were the fact that his mission is coming to an end. The tears were because he realized that when he passes away, he now loses the opportunity to make a difference in the world. He can't do any more mitzvahs. He can't study Torah anymore. That's only for souls on earth, here below. But once he's in heaven, he doesn't have all of that. Yes, he'll have great pleasures and rewards waiting for him, but he's not going to be able to do a mitzvah. And that is the deepest relationship that one could develop with God Almighty. And that's only possible in this world. And that's why he was crying as he was passing away from the world, not because he was afraid of death, but on the contrary, because he was realizing that he will now lose the opportunity to do a mitzvah here on earth. So this, I think, answers Lou's question in the chat box, asking if the soul in heaven has a relationship with God. The answer is yes, it has a relationship, but it doesn't have nearly the depth of the relationship that it has through fulfilling its mission here on earth. So the soul is created, it's in heaven, and it has a relationship with God, whatever the soul has in heaven. But then God comes to the soul and says, "Do you want to deepen your relationship with me?" It's not going to happen by staying here. If I can use an analogy, obviously not comparing to God, but we mentioned the Rebbe before. So the seventh Rebbe, unlike any other Hasidic leader, all Hasidic Rebbes in New York and Jerusalem, they all have their students living around them, building communities around them and filling up their synagogue with thousands of people. What did the Rebbe tell his students in the 1950s, 60s, 70s? He said, "Don't stay here. If you want a relationship with me, you want to be my student, don't live here in Brooklyn. Go find a community somewhere in the world that needs a rabbi, a teacher, an educator, and go build Judaism around the world." So in a sense, he was saying, if you want to really be my student and listen to my teachings, then leave. I know you don't want to leave because it's more cozy to stick around here in Brooklyn life. But if you really care about my teachings and you want to take it to heart, then I want you to leave and go build Judaism somewhere else. In a sense, same concept. God is saying, you want to stay here in heaven? Okay, you'll have greater pleasures. You'll have every kosher restaurant that you can only think of within walking distance and everything else. But if you're looking for a relationship with me, that you're going to get by going down to earth, going into a body, living in the lowly world, inhabiting a body in the lowly world, and doing what I want from you there. That's how you're going to develop a more meaningful, deeper relationship with me. Let me take a couple more questions from the chat box. You mentioned the rabbi wanted to continue his mission. How did he know that what his mission was? If you want to leave it for another time, this is also fine. Not to digress, but in short, if God puts someone in a certain place, position in life, and you find yourself confronted by a certain situation, circumstance, where you could make a difference, it's very likely that that's your mission in life. So the Rebbe, of course, got the mission from his father. He assumed his father's position, the fifth Rebbe. So he kind of knew what his mission was. And he also knew that when Judaism was being squashed under communism, he knew that he had to respond and react. And he embraced that as his mission. And he certainly wanted to continue that. And because his work wasn't finished, he knew that every day that passes, Jewish children are growing up without Judaism. If that's the case, he couldn't complete his mission and he had to continue the fight. Joanne is asking, so do souls know each other from the world? Do souls in heaven have connections with other souls? So I think what you're asking is that after souls leave this world and return to heaven, let's just say family members or parents and children or siblings, do they reunite? Do they reconnect with each other in the next world? The answer is yes. And we find references to that within the Torah, where it says about certain of our patriarchs and matriarchs, a term is used that they will be gathered onto their people after they pass away. In other words, they are reunited with the souls that they were close to here on earth. So the answer is yes. Another question here in the text, regarding the text of Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, if a soul returns to life on earth because of reincarnation, would it not make sense for a soul returned to heaven to prepare itself for its next life on earth? So first of all, I don't want to get carried away with reincarnation because we are going to cover it in another class. But briefly, Rabbi Yehuda, you know, no one knows what's awaiting. A soul doesn't know what's awaiting it. Now, it's possible that when my soul returns to heaven, it may have another journey. It may be sent down back to earth. And like I said, we'll discuss why that would be in the reincarnation class. But to answer your question, there's no way for a soul to know exactly what's awaiting it. So if a soul is here in this world, it wants to stay here. Because as far as it's concerned, it has unfinished business. And as long as it can make a difference, it wants to. And it only leaves this world when it is actually forced to, which is what happens to the soul. Okay, so with a few minutes remaining, I want to first quote a one-liner here, which is very well known, on page 18, text 13. If you can take a look at that. In Hebrew, it's five words. Elu tzadikim shebemisasan nikru'u chayim. Fascinating few words from the sages 2,000 years ago. What did they say? That after their demise, tzadikim, which means righteous people, are referred to as being alive. In other words, the righteous are alive even in death. Now, what does that mean? If it means just that the soul lives on, like we've been talking for the last hour, then why are we saying this exclusive to the righteous? Everybody's soul lives on. If the soul lives on and that's what makes us alive even after we leave this world, then every soul is alive even in death. What are we saying that's unique to the righteous? That righteous people are referred to as alive even after passing away. So what does that mean? We need to understand the statement from the sages a little bit better. So to appreciate that, there's something deeper going on here. And that is that everyone consists of a body and soul, as we've been discussing. The body eventually fades and returns to dust, but the immortal soul lives on. And that's for eternity. The question is, what about all the things that I identified with during my lifetime? What about my feelings, my thoughts, my behaviors, my dreams, my aspirations? What happens to them? Do they go with the body and basically expire? Or do they go with the soul to live on for eternity together with the soul? Following the question? So basically, what a person, the life that we live, what we identify with during our lifetime, what happens to that? Does it follow the path of the body and returns to dust? Or does it follow the soul and therefore lives on forever? This is really what this one-liner from the sages is teaching us. It's telling us this, that we have to make a distinction here between two aspects or dimensions of our lives. So while we live here on earth, okay, just look at every typical day of our life. We're busy with various things, which I think we can generally categorize in two different distinct categories. We do things that are aligned with our soul, and then we do things that are aligned more with our body. So we eat, sleep, anything physical, anything body related is of course aligned with our body. But then anything we do, any selfless act that we do, any mitzvah that we do, if we study Torah, like what we're doing right now, if we pray or we do something else, that's selfless, that's all aligned with our soul. So we do things that are, so here's the thing. Whatever we engaged in during our lifetime that was aligned with our soul, like a soul-inspired deed during our life, that does not expire. So let's say right now we're studying Torah, what we're doing right now, this act, these moments engaged in divine wisdom are going to live on forever with the soul, because these are, this, what we're doing right now is aligned with our soul. If I'm just eating, sleeping, or anything else that's physical, that follows my body and has an expiration date, just like the body does. Now, here's the thing. And now we can understand the statement that the righteous are considered alive even after they pass away. What does that mean? Why specifically the righteous are considered alive even in death? And the reason for that is this. Because the more righteous the person, the more they did during their lifetime that was aligned with their soul. So take a very super righteous individual. What do they spend their day doing? They spend their day praying. They spend their day studying Torah. They spend their day helping people. They spend their day, everything is infused with spirituality. Someone who's a spiritual person is, then from morning to night, they're spiritual. What about the fact that they're eating? What about the fact that they're sleeping? Well, eating could also turn into a spiritual activity. If I sit down to a meal, and if I'm Jewish, the meal is kosher, and I eat mindfully, I eat what I need, not just what I want, and I eat the right amount, and then with the energy that I just got from that meal, I then go do something productive, then that meal was actually a spiritual act, not a physical act. Yes, I was doing something physical, but I spiritualized that meal. The same is with my sleep. The same is with my money. If I just run after making money as much as I can, that is aligned with the body. But if I am engaged in making money so that I can then, first of all, I do so honestly. And then with my earnings, I give 10% or more to charity. What I'm doing is spiritualizing my business. I'm spiritualizing my pursuit of money, because it's not just pursuit of money. It's actually the pursuit of doing a mitzvah, of giving charity. So the righteous person, everything they do becomes aligned with their soul, even making money, even eating their next meal, even their night's sleep. Everything is aligned with their soul because they're doing so in a soulful way. If that's the case, then when they pass away, then their life, almost, let's just say, largely, everything they did during their lifetime, which was aligned with their soul, now lives on with their soul for eternity. But someone who only pursues materialism their whole life, and they're obsessed with only the physical, never pay a moment's attention to the spiritual, then when that person passes away and leaves this world, then everything they stood for during their lifetime was aligned with the body. What's happening to the body? The body is returning to dust. It ceases to exist. So everything that they stood for during their lifetime also ceases to exist. And this is the key factor here. This is the clincher. Why a righteous person is alive even in death, that's not just because they have a soul that's eternal. Everyone has a soul, and the soul is eternal. There's something more here. There's something deeper. that what they did during their lifetime, what they lived for, what they occupied themselves with, what they identified with, their thoughts, their behaviors, their aspirations, all of that was aligned with their soul during their lifetime. So now when the soul lives on, then what they lived for lives on as well, even after they left this world. And this is really our way of attaining immortality during our lifetime. And it's a very powerful idea. And I think it's, we're going to turn to the screen one more time because it is illustrated by a very powerful song by anyway, I'm not going to give it away. Let's look at the screen and we're going to have this point drive home in a very powerful way. 1 second, where are we here? Sorry. Give me 1 second. Lost my page here. Sorry, it's taking me an extra minute. Someone have a quick question while we're getting this going. Please feel free to unmute
and ask. Do you think that the soul has a choice in reincarnation?
No, I don't. I don't, for the same reason why when it comes down to this world originally, it doesn't really have a choice. And as far as we know, by the way, and again, obviously this is a topic that everybody loves and we're gonna explore it more in another class, but the very life that we're in right now may be a reincarnation. So whenever the soul comes down to earth, it initially resists it and wants to stay in heaven. Okay, can everyone see the screen? Just give me a thumbs up if you see the screen.
Eighth Day is a popular Hasidic rock band. One of their hits was inspired by a powerful episode in the life of the second leader of the Hasidic movement, Rabbi Dovber of Meserich.
A student goes to visit a sage, and the sage has nothing in his house. He says, where's your couches? Where's your chandelier? And he says back to the student, where's all your stuff? You just have a suitcase. And the student responds, but I'm just passing through. And that's when the sage says, aha, I'm just like you. I'm also just passing through.
To his student's assertion, Rabbi Dovber responded with a transformative insight.
And that's when he said, I'm just like you. I'm just passing through, just like you. My heart wants to feel something that's real, and my mind wants to find treasures of another kind. And if you had my eyes, you'd see a paradise for you and me. This world is temporary, where people spend most of their life collecting stuff. And the sage tells him, I'm actually just like you. I also collect stuff. It's just not that type of stuff, not leather couches and chandeliers. I collect treasures of another kind. You know, he stays focused on that higher goal.
Rabbi Dovber taught his students that this world's glitter is a distraction that expires when the journey of corporeality chugs to an abrupt end. Better to invest in treasures of a kind that will benefit the soul in its eternal destination.
So in conclusion and in summation of tonight's class, we started by discussing the fact that many people are overtaken by this fear of death. So based on our conversation and discussion tonight, what we have come to understand is this: we have a new perspective. We have a new perspective on life. And that is, number one, if death scares us because we naturally perceive it as the end, so number one, we need to know that it's not the end, because the soul, who is the real I, is eternal. Number two, if the end frightens us, then we should actually engage in fewer things that have expiration dates. And today, during our lifetime, we should actually make it a priority to do things that are more soul-oriented, more spiritually oriented, and therefore those things that we do during our life will actually live on together with our soul. But my last thought is that we need to realize this. This is not all or nothing. It's not that either I live a super spiritual life or I choose a super physical materialistic life. That would be a mistake. The trick is that every single day we can make one choice that is more aligned with our soul. And that one deed of that day is going to live on together with our soul. It could be 10 deeds during the day. But the key is that it's not about where we are, it's about the direction that we're going. We should be moving in a direction where our life is filled with things of another kind, something that's real. And in doing so, we will all those deeds will live on together with our soul for eternity. But perhaps more importantly, during our life here on earth, we will do so with ultimate serenity and ultimate peace. Thank you so much for joining our first class. We have two orders of business before we go. Number one, if I can just get everybody to please give us a thumbs up for a group picture. Esty told me I must take one. So give me a thumbs up. One, two, three. Perfect. Thank you very much. And I'm just going to take a couple of last questions. And if you have any, feel free to stay on and ask them. I'm not going anywhere. So I was holding at Donna Cohen, I believe. So that soul returns to heaven changed by its time on earth? Absolutely. I couldn't have said it better. The soul, with all the good deeds that it does here on earth, is changed, enhanced, achieves a satisfaction that it never could have if it would have remained in heaven. So it is totally changed and therefore has the tremendous reward waiting for it. Okay. Future reference. My name is actually okay. Rabbi, the sister. I said, kind of, okay. Thank you all for sharing. I think if anyone else has questions that they want to ask verbally by unmuting, you are welcome to do so. Otherwise, I look forward to seeing you all next Monday at 7:30. Feel free to email me or text me with any feedback, components of the class that you liked more than others, so I could tailor it in future classes. Thank you all very much. Love you all. Yes, questions?
I have one related to the idea that the soul returns to heaven changed by its time on earth. And you were saying how it's enhanced by its time on earth. Suppose the soul was in an evil person, a wicked person. And doesn't that damage the soul rather than enhance it?
Yes, you can say so. So the soul is impacted by its time on earth, and it could be impacted positively by everything we just discussed in the last few minutes of living a more soulful life aligned with our soul, or it could be impacted negatively by living a exclusively physical or obsessed with materialistic things in life. So, and we're going to be discussing this in another class, and this is the whole concept of heaven and hell, which we're going to be discussing, and that what you're asking plays directly into that, based on what the soul experiences here on earth, is what happens to it as soon as it returns to heaven. So we'll explore it more in next class. Thank you for that.
Perfect.
Rabbi, I want to thank you for the class, and also for the way you handled my question towards the beginning about the soul's purpose in this world and not just in the world to come or in the pre-world to be.
Yeah, I hope you found clarity in the process of the conversation.
It's exactly what I would have said if I were to have explained what I felt. I'm glad that you cut me off and let the class go, because that's exactly where we were headed.
Perfect. Glad to hear that. Thank you. Any other question before we go? Sid, please. Sid, yeah, just unmute and take it away.
Have a great night, Rabbi. Thank you very much.
Thank you. You were waving.
It was a wonderful. Okay. I was waving goodbye.
Thank you very much. Thanks for joining. We'll see you next time. Okay. Feel free to reach out privately if you have a question. Have a wonderful night. Take care. We'll see you next week.
Thank you.